Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combiné Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Gene Moldenhauer. Expect to learn from Gene how to assess new sterilization methods for your drug, device, and combination product, the amount of products currently that are terminally sterilized versus aseptically filled, and a thorough walkthrough of a lot of new cutting-edge sterilization methods, things like liquid phase sterilization, ionization, physics-based sterilization, high-pressure sterilization, glass bead sterilization, infrared, microwave, and a whole slew more. I hope you enjoy this episode with Gene, and if you're not already subscribed on whatever platform you're listening on, please hit that subscribe button, and let me know if you have any feedback for the show.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combiné Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
Let's say focusing on combination products to begin with, you're it by whatever fact is the limiter. And what I mean by that is, if the drug is the limiter, then the sterilization of the drug, the processing of the drug, so on and so forth, generally becomes the harder part to work with, and vice versa with the device if you have a sensitive device constituent. And so when you're talking about new sterilization methods, in my experience, there's typically a lot more rationale, justification for going that route. And so before we jump into the actual sterilization methods, how do you discount the cornucopia of different available sterilization methods that are known, widely understood, widely used, widely available, et cetera, okay, before you evaluate some of the cutting edge?
That was one of the big fears when in the around 1994 and since then, regulatory agencies in both Europe and the United States got into this thing that you have to evaluate terminal sterilization before you can go to aseptic filling. And while I say that's a requirement, what's quite interesting is that according to the most recent survey of pharmaceutical companies, 80% of drugs are still aseptically filled, and many of them can be. Yeah, they run one every 10 years from PDA. Igalico and Akers and Madsen. And the most recent one still showed that 80% of drugs are aseptically filled. And if you happen to look, parenteral drugs, large volume parenterals greater than 100 mLs, you're not allowed to aseptically fill them. There's a couple of very small exceptions for things like chemotherapy drugs, where if you were trying to terminally sterilize them, you could run a problem from hazards. But for the most part, everything has to be terminally sterilized. If you look, there's a lot of small volume parenterals that are the exact same drug as a large volume parenteral. But when they're small volume, people are aseptically filling them. And if it's a large volume, they have to be terminally sterilized. So the regulators decided to start putting more pressure on us in regulatory submissions and be able to prove that it can't be terminally sterilized. And so we went through that whole heartthrob problem. How many processes do you have to try? Are you adding 10 years to the development of any new drug? Things like that. And the EMEA came out with, it's called the EME sterilization decision tree. And it was a separate document originally. And right now it's part of their development documents, but it starts out and says you try an overkill cycle for steam sterilization. And if it can't do an overkill cycle, it's got an option for a cycle I'm going to say heat sensitive, but it's got one other kind of cycle you can do. And if you can't do that, can you do dry heat or radiation? And you go through a few steps, and from there you get to aseptic filling. And so that helped a lot because it cut down how many different things you had to try. And for a lot of these methods, for example, dry heat is at such a high temperature that by knowing what your components are for something, you'll know you can't do this because it'll melt. So it wasn't like you had to do specific studies for each of those steps. You could use literature to support them. So that's a convenient way to get to whether you have to sterilize it or not. I'm a proponent, I know this will shock you, of sterilization over aseptic filling, but it gave you a roadmap of how far you had to go. So just because I know about 5-10 new technologies, you don't have to evaluate them. It's a good practice if you can, and if you can do at least a little homework to see if they're appropriate, that's nice. But from a regulatory point of view, there's just the 5 standards: dry heat, wet heat, gas, and aseptic filling. I'm missing one, but there's 5 regular ones.
Irradiation,
that was it. For some reason, when I get talking, I miss one every time.
Yeah, that's a long list. As far as, because for some of these, not all of these, the environment, the bio load that's on the product becomes important in terms of evaluating whether or not the sterilization process will be effective. You did mention overkill, though. I guess I'm wondering, when you're doing those evaluations, presumably you want to do them as early as possible. And so is there a difficulty in doing that where you need to have some qualified processes to evaluate real product and say, you know, if you're just building product in some lab, that may not. Actually, that would always be worst case, wouldn't it?
Yes. Could be worst case. You could use biological indicators because they're a much higher level challenge. So I can buy commercial biological test kits, for lack of a better word, that would be a higher challenge than I would find in my environment. So I could challenge them at a very high level to see if they can withstand killing off a very high level of contamination. But the thing is, it's not really that hard to do all these. It sounds hard, and there are days when I would like to throw the product through the wall. But in most cases, you have some knowledge. I know for a fact that if my biological indicator is Geobacillus thermophilus, which is considered one of the hardest to sterilize moist heat units, if I use that organism, I know certain things about it. I know that if it's in a simple salt solution, a monovalent salt solution, the resistance to heat will become much higher. So it may start out with a heat resistance of 2 minutes, and it could go up to 8 or 10 or 11 minutes in a simple salt solution. So there are some things like that, that knowing what the product is and knowing what biological indicator I want to use. Bacillus smithii isn't affected at all by low-level salt concentrations, but calcium chloride, divalent ions, will make it go high. And there's some things that by knowing the formulation and that you can look for and know what kinds of risks you'll have, say with steam sterilization. The same kinds of things are true with other types of sterilization. For example, is the material going to be compatible with the sterilization cycle? And stuff like that. So you can do a lot of your homework before you ever actually start testing the product. Hey, this isn't going to work because this and this. And so it's not as hard.
So EMEA is the medicines agency in Europe. Is there a two-part question? Is there an equivalent kind of expectation on evaluation for devices in Europe? And then is there a parallel for U.S. worldwide? Is it widely used as a standard in terms of that evaluation pathway?
Okay. The testing for devices, it's just most commonly radiation and gas type sterilizations for devices. The only exception to that is if you're making, say, a kit or part of the kit has a drug component, because then the drug would fall more under the drug side. The devices, they don't seem to have an expectation that you go through as many sterilization processes. What they do have an expectation is what the probability of a non-sterile unit is. So in some cases, that might be 10 to the minus 3. In other cases, it might be 10 to the minus 6, where 10 to the minus 6 is not more than one non-sterile unit in a million. And that really drives some of what kind of sterilization process you want. And that's based on how the device is used with humans. Is it inside the body? Is it outside the body? Just touching the skin, things like that.
And then U.S. versus EU kind of thing?
Sure. The U.S. never came out with a specific guidance document, but they accept the path that's in the EM document. In 1994, they put out a sterile process validation documentation requirements for submissions guidance document. And in today, it's the same requirements, but it's been translated into what they call a MAP document, M-A-P-P. In this case, it's MAP 5040.1. And it tells you what categories of information you need in the regulatory submission. And part of it is you have to, if you're not terminally sterilizing, you have to explain why. I don't go into as much detail as I have to try these five paths, but I have to have a rationale for why I'm not terminally sterilizing.
Okay. So basically the decision tree that you mentioned
is
recognized. It's recognized, but the actual expectation is not the specific decision tree as much as it is the last few elements of it, which is the rationale for what evaluations went into it and why you're moving forward with an alternate kind of sterilization or aseptic fill. I guess going into the actual methods, there were some unique ones that I really hadn't understood. And in my head, the five categories that you had mentioned, now the dry and moist heat, gas, aseptic are the big buckets really that I've seen. And anything that was novel was just a novel radiation or a novel gas. But
the biggest change recently is that FDA, when they came out with their USP chapter 1229 with all the subsets, they started adding in some other things that people could look at for sterilization. So part of it was new gas. USP 1229 is a whole section on sterilization, and I think it's got 11 or 12 subparts. It has saturated steam, non-saturated steam cycles, things like that. They started adding in, one of the big ones was liquid phase sterilization. So over the years, I've always heard this solution sterilizes itself because it's sporicidal. It's going to kill the bacteria that's present in my product. Why do I have to sterilize it? They gave you an option now of showing that is the sterilization cycle.
But how does liquid phase sterilization work?
You would still qualify it, and you still have to show your 6-log reduction or 12-log total reduction, 6 logs of BI kill, and it's half cycle quals. So you'd show 6 logs and double the cycle.
It sounds like it doesn't sound like it's a sterilization method where you have a container or product and you're applying an external force, be it a gas or be it a wave, and essentially changing the product. It sounds like it's part of the product.
It could be part of the product, or it could actually just be a liquid cycle that you choose to use. I'll give you an example. There's a lot of people today trying to make artificial organs with 3D printing. And some are farther along in the development process than others. But one of the problems they get to is, okay, I made my kid. I'm just picking kidneys because that's a common one. I made my kidney. How do I sterilize it to put it in the human body? I'm not going to obviously take it and put it in a steam sterilization cycle, and I can't aseptically fill it. But in most of these kinds of operations, there's some kind of machine it's in. in my mind, I think of it as like being an incubator. And they clean it and they run solutions through it. Now it's not been considered that I could run a solution through it that would kill all the bacteria and viruses present without harming it. And so there are different solutions out there that have those kinds of properties. And you can rinse it or recirculate it around these items and sterilize them. And say you show a 6-log reduction of BI in 5 minutes. I can take that and change that to a half cycle qual and say, if I need 5 minutes to kill 6 logs, then 10 minutes will kill 12 logs. And they've done that successfully with different kinds of things like that, where I can't do other things with it, but I can use these rinses or recirculating solution to kill what I need to kill off and sterilize it. The only trick is figuring out how you're getting it after you sterilize it and keeping it sterile. So in some cases, in like the artificial organs, they may have to transfer it in a sterile container to what they want to do. But they've had to develop a lot of these new methods because of all the new things we're doing with things like 3D printers. Another one that would be near and dear to you is think about chlorhexidine. Chlorhexidine is a disinfectant. A lot of kits want to have a chlorhexidine solution as part of their kit. And the problem is it's always in some kind of sealed container inside the kit. The gas doesn't penetrate into a sealed container. So the gas sterilization I would normally do can't get in. Some versions of chlorhexidine are degraded by radiation. So what do? I'm at a loss if it has to be a sterile kit. And so I may be able to show that the chlorhexidine itself self-sterilizes inside the container, and the gas just has to, or radiation just has to kill the rest of the kit.
Okay. But from a liquid phase, is it fair to say that most of the application of it would be outside of the drug device area and more on the, I guess I'm thinking in my head, like, most of the things that are medical device or pharma related wouldn't be things that you could flush out?
As a general rule, the place where you could use them in drugs, again, is say I have a sealed container of chlorhexidine or some other.
Yeah.
It could be a low pH solution that kills. It could be acidic. There's a bunch of things where the solution itself may just kill microorganisms. And so I could be in a sealed container. And it could kill on its own. It could prove that it got the right log reduction.
And so I actually don't, I haven't really, I don't know what chlorhexidine is, but I'm thinking
it's about a disinfectant solution that they use with kits. Often it's with wound care kits.
Sure. And so that's where my head was going, is if you had a bottle of hydrogen peroxide, one could theoretically say that bottle is self-sterilizing.
Yes.
That's the same idea? Okay.
Same concept.
That makes sense. I've actually heard that positive. Way back, I worked on a family of chemo drugs, and somebody mentioned something to that effect, that chemo drugs may self-sterilize, and
yes,
the additional sterilization was just the kind of a cherry on top. But I'm just going back, like I didn't really think about it much other than it was something that I heard and was archived in my brain, but it wasn't something that I questioned. I was like, we're sterilizing it, so didn't really matter at the time. But is that true? Are there actual drugs outside of the common things like hydrogen peroxide and chlorhexidine you just mentioned that are self-sterilizing?
Stop and think about, what's a chemotherapy drug do? It goes and kills human cells, right? If it's strong enough to kill human cells, it probably is also strong enough to kill bacteria and viruses. Yeah. And so it could be self-sterilizing. It just depends. There are some chemotherapy drugs that, oddly enough, don't kill it. I don't know how they kill the cancer cells, but they're weird drugs. Well, one of the ones I think of most often is, if you're familiar with the drug thalidomide, it caused all the birth defects in kids. they use a thalidomide derivative today to make a drug for myeloma. And I don't actually understand how it kills, other than whatever caused the defects in kids. But that particular drug may or may not kill bacteria in that, because I don't understand enough how it kills in the human cells. But there are some that are very obvious. They kill the human cells, they kill the bacteria and the viruses at the same time.
So in terms of, let's just go through the list and maybe go through a handful of some of these. Ionization technology and physics-based sterilization.
Yeah. Oddly enough, as a microbiology, I really like physics-based technologies. Basically, what happens is some wise scientists in Israel were able to show that all bacteria and viruses are negatively charged. And physics-based technologies, you may have heard of some of them using copper ions or silver ions or something. Those ions have a positive charge. And so when they come in contact with the negatively charged bacteria or viruses, it has an electrical charge. I like to think of it as a little bolt of lightning, and kills the virus or bacteria. The only downside is some of these heavy metal ions, you can't get out of your body. So you got to be careful about how many you're putting in your body. There are newer physics-based technologies that create the ions in a different way. One of the surface disinfectants that's out there uses the autohydrolysis properties of water and the autoionization properties to discharge the water with hydronium ions. And so all it is water. It meets the drinking water standards, but it'll kill all your bacteria and viruses. So that's one. Other ones use other ways to get the positive charge. And again, this keeps happening where it just kills them. Normally, you want it to be on the acid side for the kill. There's just other ones that do these same things that are physics-based. Their big advantage is that your body doesn't have a way to build up a resistance to physics.
All right. So moving into another sterilization method that I was interested in exploring, high pressure sterilization.
Okay.
I haven't heard of that before.
Yeah. It's just like it sounds. Instead of using atmospheric pressure, they use a higher pressure to achieve the sterilization. Depending on how high the pressure is, some of it might just explode the cells.
Is that right?
Why? Some are really high pressure, but basically that's what it does. It creates a higher pressure on the outside of the cell than the inside, and it lyses the cells. And that was actually one. There was a sterilization conference for people in Chicago a couple years ago, where they focused on sterilization methods. And that was one of the ones that was presented as ones that they were evaluating for parenterals. Not as easy to convert to, because existing steam sterilizers are pressure vessels. You'd again need special kind of pressure vessels and that. And I don't think that they worked out all the bugs for all the different kinds of containers and solutions, but it's one that come up in several different research papers and that, of things that they're looking at and evaluating for some kinds of products. It maybe doesn't work for everything, but one of the ones, oddly enough, they were looking at was parenterals.
Really?
Struck me as odd.
Yeah. What are the main, you have pressure, temperature, and then if you're introducing
time,
but if you're, I'm saying like in a chamber, there is no, for radiation, there's no pressure temperature element, right? It's just dose.
Normally, yes.
And then with heat sterilization, it's temperature, pressure, time.
Heat, dry heat, it's just temperature and time. No pressure.
There's no pressure for dry heat.
That's like when they use the ovens to, the same way they do depyrogenation, they sterilize at high temperature in an oven.
So high temperature sterilization is basically just baking.
Predominantly for glass. Yeah. We do it for glass. You're at temperatures high enough to depyrogenate. And one log of depyrogenation is equivalent to killing 100 logs of spores. It overkills if you're depyrogenating at the same time. But generally, the thing we use it for is glass, to prepare glass for an aseptic fill or something like that.
But, and we'll go back to the novel stuff here in a second, but depyrogenation is at a higher level than sterilization. And so you can do
it's a higher temperature you have to do to achieve it. And so because you're going to a much higher temperature, remember when we talked about D values and how much and Z values were, if you change the temperature by a certain number, it also mm-hmm. causes a log of reduction. You go to such a high temperature and depyrogenation that you're killing many logs at a time of bacteria.
Yeah, but the depyrogenation tunnels that I've seen have all been in line.
Yes.
Pre-fill. It's a preparation step as part of
it. And that's how it is generally when they use deep dry heat sterilization. Again, they're prepping glassware to use in an aseptic process usually.
Okay. But dry heat is not used beyond that for just sterilizing as the main sterilization method?
It could be.
Question, sure, but I'm saying I'll take your, if you haven't seen it, I'm sure I haven't. Yeah. And so you're saying in the only context that dry heat is mostly used in is in depyrogenation, which includes an element of sterilization as well.
Yes.
Okay.
And some companies choose, particularly when they make the bigger glass bottles, they just use an oven type device. It's not a tunnel. And with the oven type device, they put the big bottles in, normally with foil over the top of the bottle and heat it up. They don't need as many logs of kill if they just want to sterilize.
Huh.
A shorter time, like 6 hours. So none of it. It's just a shorter time to get the log reduction they want.
Okay. It's a new, let me go back into this article here. Sorry. Glass bead. That one threw me for a loop.
Yeah. Glass that's bead. Not well, at all common.
No.
Trying to think of a good way to explain it. Normally the beads are coated with something and they do it. That's one way they do it. Another way is when you have things that are high viscosity, they use beads inside the container to keep the material moving. Normally, one of the big advantages of using glass beads and moving and that is that the material that you're sterilizing doesn't settle out on the bottom and cook and get brown and crusted in the material. So it usually has more to do with helping the material you're sterilizing, like the equivalent of using a stir bar.
What is a stir bar?
One of those little magnetic things that when you're mixing a solution, you put it in on top of a magnetic stir. Pardon me. And it keeps the solution rotating while it's heating up so that you get the whole solution.
Huh. Interesting. And it's not common, the use case.
I've mostly seen it used for preventing the product itself from degrading during the sterilization cycle by keeping it moving.
And then there are other sterilization methods, like it's basically new versions of the same things that we've seen historically under irradiation or gas, right?
There's those and flash sterilization where they run it at a very high temperature. If you're making a very big batch size, say irrigation solutions or that in plastic bottles, the irrigation solutions that they use in surgicals, they can run them all in line and run them through piping that's at 300 degrees or higher. And it only needs to travel in the pipe for a minute and it'll get more than a 10 to the minus 6 sterility assurance level. And so they can run it through this really hot line and collect it in the billing line, and it's already sterilized. They can.
And the product can handle the 300 degrees?
Yes, because the irrigation solutions are very often things like simple salt solutions. If you have something that's not heat sensitive, you can do a very high temperature for a very short time. And actually, when you have heat sensitive products, the normal thing people want to do to be able to sterilize them is sterilize them at a lower temperature, thinking that'll be better for them. A lower temperature, longer time, longer. And that'll sterilize them. But that actually causes more product degradation than if they went to a high temperature for a very short time.
Is that
it's just
right?
An engineering calculation, the Arrhenius calculation.
I've used that for calculating stability time.
Uh-huh. But
what? Because that's commonly used.
Correct.
For accelerated aging in particular. But what's the connection?
There's an engineering use of it for calculating degradation. It's also a part of stability, how quickly it's going to degrade. And so the higher temperature for a very short time gives you the sterility assurance level you need with much less degradation to the product.
Huh. So diving into those two buckets, the new methods under gas.
That one is normally with steam sterilization, the flash. They run high temperatures.
Sorry, I was moving on, but let's discuss that. Let's discuss that. So the flash is typically with steam.
Correct.
Because depyrogenation happens quick in line.
With dry heat.
So that's, with dry heat. But that's what I was imagining when you were saying that it's done continuous. And so
the tunnel is considered continuous when they go through a heat tunnel.
Like a deep, But then how do they... But you said that for the irrigation solutions, they would do that continuous as well, no?
It's a hot pipe, a very hot pipe that's got steam normally around the pipe to keep it very hot. So the solution's running through the pipe, exposed to very high temperatures, and by the time they fill it into the bottle, it's already sterilized.
Oh, it's aseptic fill.
Yeah, in a weird way. They don't need to filter that because it's already sterilized from being in line.
Oh, okay. I
like
understand.
An aseptic process without filtration.
Okay, that's a good way to put it. So I understand what you're saying. So with flash, it's being sterilized by its transfer from the tank into the container.
Correct.
And there is no 22 micron filter that's somewhere in the middle between that. That's
no, unless they just have a filter in for other people filter for particulates and other things. So people could use a filter, but it's not the critical part. Sterilization's coming from the high temperature.
Interesting. Then moving on to gas. There's the EO that has been used a lot, but there are new, and we've discussed that in the other podcasts at length. We've also discussed some of probably the ones that we're going to discuss now, but just to make sure that this is rounded out in the novel methods. Chlorine dioxide, VHP.
Nitrogen dioxide.
Nitrogen dioxide. Are those the main ones that are used? Ozone?
Ozone, parasitic acid. Again, the parasitic acid has come in more. Parasitic acid was used a long time ago for sterilization. And then it fell out of favor for some reason. And now it's become more popular again with a lot of these new things like artificial organs and some of the eye parts and things like that that they sterilize. But it's come back into favor.
And those would all still be considered the newer. Okay.
In new ways. Okay. Even if now. Parasitic acid may have been around for a long time, but how we're using it to sterilize now is considered a newer technology.
Are there any of those gas sterilization methods? Because you've mentioned organs, you've mentioned cancer drugs. for certain applications. Are there any of the new gases that are being looked at and explored more for combination products?
I think a few people have looked at chlorine dioxide and nitrogen dioxide for those, and they've tried them on the vendor website. There's a very small number of companies that have them. And in most cases, it's something similar to Steris or one of the other ones, Sterigenics, where you send your product there to be sterilized. There's not a lot of people that built chlorine dioxide or nitrogen dioxide sterilizers at their plant. And so then you don't hear as much about the details, you know, whereas if you've been at the plant where they do it, you get a lot more details and about what kind of products they're doing.
Yeah.
What about irradiation?
Because irradiation's always happy. Is whether you're doing typical gamma or if you're going to do E-beam or beta radiation.
Yeah. I saw infrared and microwave, which I think were...
They exist.
Not as common, right?
No, they're not as common. The big trend today is looking at E-beam because, first off, it's very low cost, very short time periods, and low dose. Comparatively, I know one of the companies that does that routinely, I think they were talking about it, runs about $1 a vial, and they can turn it around, your product around in 48 hours. And you are sterilizing it in a case or a curtain. For a lot of people, that's a good deal. If I can go send it, they'll have it back to me in 48 hours. Not too bad. Buying one of those sterilizers in line. I think there's some a couple meters length and they run a little over $1 million. It may be cheaper to send it out. Since I had trouble getting my budgets approved for $250,000, I don't know about $1 million, how happy they'd be for that.
Yeah. In terms of looking at these new sterilization methods, we talked early on, I just want to round this out, about the EMEA flow. But what do you recommend to folks before discounting the existing methods? Because I suppose in my limited experience, sometimes there was a clear need. And sometimes, I don't know how to say this, but sometimes the use of a new cutting edge technology can be looked at as an attractive thing to do. What do you recommend in terms of those evaluations beyond the EMEA?
Well, first off, I love a lot of the new technologies. I like rapid micro methods. I like rapid sterilization methods. I like all of that. However, I will tell you that when people come in with new technologies and they'd come to my office and want to tell me how they're going to implement them in pharmaceutical companies within 2 years, I'm like, you'll be lucky to get an appointment to show it to a pharmaceutical company within 2 years. Pharmaceuticals are just very reluctant to change. And one of the big reasons is they never believe that the regulators will accept the new methods. And you could have a regulator get up at a meeting and tell them, we really like this new method. It goes along with our philosophy on determining when things happen earlier in the process and whatever. And companies still don't believe them. So nobody wants to be first with a new method. The only time they want to be first with a new method is if there is no method that anybody got to work for something. Again, with like all these 3D printers and things like that, they had to look at new methods because traditional methods, there wasn't a way to make them work with a lot of these biotech products.
Do you think that when programs will go towards evaluating for new process for one of the newer sterilization methods, I suppose in your experience, I'll ask the question a different way. In your experience, are you having to tell programs to go back and do more evaluations before they start exploring the new stuff? Or do they typically reach out to you and you see the body of evidence and you're like, yeah, you all have tried everything. Let's start trying to slap something on and see if it sticks in comparison?
Well, I'm going to tell you a question I got asked in court one time on a patent lawsuit. Did I ever believe that it was really novel to sterilize this product. Or have I ever had a problem where I didn't believe we could sterilize a product? The real world is, in all the years I've worked, ignoring the 3D printed organs here, there's never a product that we couldn't find one of the five traditional cycles to work on.
Really?
I mean, there is, well, in all the years I worked at big companies.
When you say the five cycles.
In all the years, yeah, I'm talking about steam, dry heat, radiation, gas, or aseptic. We've always been able to sterilize, find a way that'll work. It might have taken a while.
Yeah.
Or we might have had to change a few parameters, or maybe we did a combination of aseptic filling with a shorter sterilization cycle. But you can make them work with some patience and some whatever. For me, there are so many safety issues with ETO. ETO is a great sterilant. It penetrates really well into the product and things like that. But there are so many safety issues with ETO that I don't have heartburn about evaluating the new gases right up front in doing them. And the way the sterilization process validation guideline for the U.S. is written, it breaks the categories down into those same things: moist heat, dry heat, gas, and radiation. When it does that, the requirements for what kind of data you have to do are all the same, regardless of what kind of gas sterilization cycle you use. So there's no real big reason that you can't go to a different one if you want. You may not, you may be generating data that other people haven't done before, but there's no restrictions because you already have an FDA guideline that tells you, here's what we want to see for justifying the sterilization cycle. Gas is pretty easy to change. Same thing with radiation. That same guidance document tells you what they want to see for a radiation package. It's when you get into things like liquid phase or that, there did used to be a lot of rules, but this new chapter of USP, the 1229 with the subsets, gives all the details. And so it tells you exactly what you have to do to validate it. So you have a USP chapter to use as the basis for how to qualify your cycle, and it's hard to say, no, I'm not going to accept what USP said.
Yeah. And so you were going to send me the link to that. You were going to send me the link to the EMEA. If you can share with me those things that we discussed, I'll put them in the show notes. Where can people find you, Gene?
Excel, EXCEL pharma.com or net.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on the show again. This was great.
You're welcome. Thanks. It's been great.